My name is Paul Weber. It is, as usual, my pleasure to welcome you to the November 2003 Alpha Teleseminar, Personal Services and in Public Health Issues. Before I introduce our faculty, I'd like to note that this teleseminar is sponsored in part by Virox Technologies of Mississauga, and my thanks to Randy Pilon and his crew at Virox for their support. Christian Lapentie is probably known to most of you. He's a public health inspector for the City of Ottawa and deals particularly with infection control in personal services settings. I receive a regular email from him, sort of like a e-newsletter, and it's always a very interesting read, sometimes an enlightening read, to present the teleseminar, Personal Services in Public Health Issues. I give you the one and certainly the only Christian Lapentie.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you very much, Paul, for that wonderful introduction and giving me the opportunity to present my topic today. On the second slide is my phone number and email, so please feel free to contact me for any questions, comments, criticisms. Most of the information that I will be discussing and resources that I will be presenting to you today are either already available or being developed in electronic format. I also have a distribution list. Paul was mentioning of public health professionals who I occasionally send and receive emails to and from for information sharing purposes. So if anybody requires anything or is interested in being in on the distribution list, just send me an email or give me a call and let me know. Now, the next slide is our topics. They're loosely intertwined or not clearly separated by subject. I will attempt to cover every topic, but just in case I don't have the opportunity, at least you will have the information and slide handouts should you need to contact me regarding any further information or clarification on any of these slides. I assume that most of you are somewhat well acquainted with or at least well aware of the Personal Services Settings Protocol, so this presentation will not be like a PSP 101, but rather an update on what has occurred with the Personal Services Setting Protocol since it was first introduced in 98, what has changed, what is coming, as well as news in general. Now, the next slide is somewhat more of a personal history, really. The Personal Service Setting Protocol was released in 98. It was to reduce and control the spread of infectious disease. This is part of the mandatory programs, should be enforced by all health units. Unfortunately, not all health units have the staff or background in this area of inspection. Although public health inspectors have been inspecting some of these locations for quite some time, there is now one document dedicated to the personal services in Ontario, which all health units can refer to, which is up to date. So at least we're all going from the same page here. When I first showed interest in this field in the early 90s, I visited several personal service establishments, roughly about six or seven municipalities or health units, and asked them if or how often they had actually seen a public health inspector. Not only had most of them never seen an inspector, but when they did, the inspector was not really knowledgeable about their trade. There is not a lot of reliable information on these establishments, the diseases associated with them, or inspection of them. And as a Ryerson graduate, these very new topics were not even part of the curriculum when I was there. I gave a lecture on this at Ryerson recently, and the students have been calling me ever since, so I assume personal services will eventually take their place in infection control alongside restaurants, pools, rabies, and the like. It's actually quite fitting that I'm presenting on this topic through Alpha because the first time I'd ever seen a PSSP draft was when Andy Papadopoulos actually handed it to me. And the next slide, we have our provincial document, which I always answer to first because sometimes you're going to use multiple reference copies when you're searching for the right answer, obviously. The next slide is the Health Canada document, which came out in 99. Other good Health Canada publications include hand washing, cleaning, disinfection, and sterilization in healthcare, and guidelines for foot care by healthcare providers is actually pretty good too. The next slide is referring to bylaws. Sometimes guidelines are taken from bylaws, and through my distribution list recently, I contacted several health units with regards to licensing personal services because I wanted to start it up here in Ottawa. I was somewhat surprised to find that this was only done by a few health units. Personal services should be treated the same as restaurants with regards to approval of the premises for opening, which would be great, of course. Any information that I can get together further with this licensing and the details of how it's being done and how to go about it, I'll certainly send it out to everyone. I believe that the city of Brantford was one that had this strictest legislation policy in place, which is obviously very useful if you have to move beyond the PSSP. The strictest legislation should always be applied when you have multiple options. And just about any legislation can be referred to in personal services, really, because as long as you can prove a public health hazard, as defined by Section 13 of the HPPA, you can write up an order. And I'll talk a little more about this later. The next slide refers to the states. Some of the states in the USA have an excellent method of trying to properly educate and train the workers and operators prior to allowing them to perform services on clients. An industry magazine on nails I read last year listed licensing educational data from North America. 34 states and 4 provinces were listed with as much as 700 hours of schooling and or field training in states such as California required for a license to operate. So in Canada at the time of that publication, Manitoba seemed to have the best combination of school hours and apprenticeship for operators. Clearly this should be adopted in Ontario, which at this point has no licensing agreement. The next slide highlights what's new in personal services in general. Knowledge of the risks associated with personal services has grown dramatically since 98 when it was released. I've had a lot more involvement from the personal service industry with regards to wanting more information and documentation. More and more cases of infections are being reported, and far more of these are being accurately reported. I would suggest that this is because more attention is being paid to personal services than previously was the case. An example of past problems with reporting was highlighted to me in an article from the CDC on infections related to piercing. When I spoke to the author about specifying the piercing methods, he had made no distinction between body piercing and gun piercing. So in retrospect, all the major infection problems were caused by guns and not by body piercing, and naturally this totally changed the slant of his study. The latest articles that I've been seeing reporting piercing problems and infections have been a lot more specific about the method of piercing. The next slide lists some of the changes that are specific to the personal services setting protocol, such as adding more explicit information in the form of charts and tables from Health Canada. Thank you very much. There is new sections and changes to existing sections as well. Most of these will be addressed later, but there is a couple that I want to go over quickly right now because they're not mentioned again later in the presentation. Electrolysis being one of them. Sterilization of tweezers or forceps is no longer mandatory, which means that an electrologist no longer requires sterilization equipment to operate. Originally, the Electrolysis College of Canada had swab tweezers and showed that in some cases bodily fluid was present, therefore encouraging sterilization. This was not complicated to enforce, really, because organizations such as COPE already had sterilization in place as a requirement, and many of the electrologists were members of these types of organizations. So it wasn't a far leap there. Every other sterile item was single-use, disposable, so electrologists were essentially buying autoclaves and dry heat sterilizers simply for the tweezers or forceps. Tweezers are not invasive, they do not penetrate sterile tissues, and they're not used to remove ingrown hairs. That's also a new listing on the PSSP. Cleaning and intermediate level disinfection is sufficient for it. When you consider the amount of blood that you're going to get on tweezers or forceps compared to, say, a manicure or a pedicure, manicure and pedicure items are likely to be far more contaminated, but still only require intermediate level disinfection themselves. Had we kept the sterilization requirements as they were, the next move would have been to enforce sterilization pretty much for a very large percentage of personal service establishments. Sterilization is always recommended, but it's only mandatory for service is invasive by nature. Another topic, hand hygiene. As we all know, proper hand hygiene is the most effective method of reducing disease transmission. The original chorus of this Public Health 101 anthem naturally referred to hand washing, which is still applicable, but has now been joined by hand sanitizers. It's also common knowledge that using an alcohol-based hand sanitizer with an emollient or skin conditioning agent to prevent chapped skin is more effective at killing viruses and bacteria than soap and water. Only takes a fraction of the time, dries quickly, and moisturizes too, so you're getting a 3 for there. Of course, there is if there is heavy microbial soiling on the hands, you must always wash with soap and water first. So the whole point there is that there's no escaping the sink issue in that situation. What I had done originally is I had tattoo artists and body piercers using hand sanitizers back in the late 90s for glove changes during the procedures, which they preferred because they didn't have to interrupt the flow of work with their clients. It's clearly important when you have open several sterile packages with invasive tools lying about and you're about to perform a service. I also found it useful with any service where the sink was not immediately handy or going to the sink was just not likely to happen. And in a case like that, I would be referring to something like your typical manicure trolley that you'll find in hair salons. And that way, at least they have the hand sanitizer right there along with a surface disinfectant, etc. I'd noticed that hand hygiene had greatly increased in Ottawa amongst the operators, and I brought that finding to the working group meetings, and that's pretty much what got the ball rolling with the hand hygiene. Also, the sink debate, of course, was a lively one amongst the working group sessions with regards to hand washing and cleaning of tools. Now, by recognizing and accepting hand sanitizers, at least the hand hygiene was accomplished more often and more effectively, which kind of saved on the sink issue. The sink moved from being in the immediate working area to being accessible. The only area where the sink is not mandatory at this time is when gun piercing is done with a fully encapsulated, sterile, single-use disposable cartridge. I'll talk more about that a little later. And next slide. Originally, the PSSP did not clearly define acupuncture as a service to be inspected. Acupuncture fell under the but not limited to clause. And on the next slide is actually a scan of the but not limited to clause. And it's on page 1 in the applicability section and was meant to cover services not specifically mentioned. So there was the possible assumption that acupuncture services would be offered by physicians. But a doctor of acupuncture is not a regulated health profession. Therefore, it's the health unit's responsibility to ensure acupuncturists are practicing proper infection control. Next slide. The problem with not having a specific acupuncture section, like the electrolysis section, is that acupuncture would fall under the general requirements. Now, that can be interpreted as allowing needles to be manipulated, as they are with tattooing and body piercing. Although the critical items section notes that some items must be single use, there was no reference to acupuncture in the document at all. So that was a problem. Next, manipulation of needles occurs in a few sections of the PSSP, but the electrolysis section stipulates sterile, single use, disposable, and that's what I was kind of hoping for the acupuncture section as well. Now, the next slide, which is slide 13 now. We're still talking about sterilization here. Slide 14, manipulation of needles. And 15, what we're referring to in 15, I'm sure most of you have the handouts, but I'm going to try to explain the graphics as I'm going along. 15 is actually a photo of a needle bar with the needles soldered onto it for tattooing. And the needles have to be soldered onto the bar in tattooing, and different configurations make a different size paintbrush. You know, just to excuse the term there, but it's probably a good way of visualizing it. And it allows for different types of line work or shading to be accomplished. Now, the next photo is actually a syringe tip, but it's the same concept as a piercing needle, with the only difference being a different size gauge on the needle. Typical piercing needles are 16 gauge, and the plastic hub, which you see in the top right corner, must be removed, and the length of the needle is sometimes altered according to the type of piercing. When a full-length needle is required, the adhesive under the hub must also be dealt with. So essentially, you're going to get manipulation of the needle depending on the type of piercing and the length of needle. Excuse me. Number 17, the electrolysis section, again, clearly defines no reuse of needles, but it does not specify that the needles must be supplied pre-sterilized and pre-packaged. Slide 18, I decided to put together an acupuncture policy here in Ottawa. I based it on three sources, the personal services, of course, always being first, infection control in the physician's office, which some of you may be familiar with, and the Clean Needle Technique Manual. The Clean Needle Technique Manual is what acupuncturists are trained and tested on to work in the United States. But there's also a Canadian connection, which is why I brought it in. Acupuncturists in British Columbia must keep a reference copy in the office. They don't necessarily have to be trained on it, but they have to have it on hand. One of my operators in Ottawa had purchased an autoclave and with sterilizing needles as required by the PSSP. So legally, he was in compliance, and oddly enough, it was also good that he was sterilizing his needles for another reason. He was getting his needles from a manufacturer that was not sterilizing needles prior to shipping. Some manufacturers from the Asian countries do not sterilize their needles prior to shipping and often package them in bundles as well. I'd informed a Japanese manufacturer that sterilization was required for his products in Ontario. Now, I realized that was jumping the gun a bit, but it seemed inevitable that eventually a specific acupuncture section would be in place. I sent this information out to the ministry and my distribution list, and that was in August of 2000, to inform other health units about this concern. Even though I don't think many other health units were actually inspecting acupuncturists back then, this company was called the Ito Company, ITO, in Japan, and they told me from that point onwards that they would mark their packages as not sterile and sterilized prior to use. So that was one of the main reasons for my acupuncture document in the first place, where in following with the PSSP, I said, okay, well, it has to be sterile, it has to be single use, it has to be disposable. But I wasn't really stipulating pre-packaged because at that point it was unclear. Slide 19, when the infections from the acupuncture occurred in Toronto, it was an unfortunate opportunity to insert a specific acupuncture section, which is what happened. And to make a long story shorter, we now have a proposed acupuncture section which addresses the needle issue completely and takes care of that. On the 20th slide, I've highlighted some of the main points just discussed previously. Next slide. An issue that also needs to be brought to everyone's attention is that acupuncture and traditional Chinese medicine have applied to become a regulated health profession under the Regulated Health Professions Act. Electrologists and body piercers with no success have previously attempted this, but in the case of acupuncture and traditional Chinese medicine, the ministry had actually started moving forward with regulating acupuncture and traditional Chinese medicine prior to the recent Ontario elections, which pretty much halts everything. Clearly, it would be premature to assume that the newly elected government will follow through, but this application has far more momentum than previous failed ones, so it's possible. I shouldn't comment on it otherwise than that, though. Next slide, one of the emerging issues in personal services is mycobacteria infections. Presently, I'm undertaking a research project with Dr. Syed Sitar of the Center for Research on Environmental Microbiology, or CREM, and this is one of our main focuses. Dr. Sitar and myself are putting together a manuscript on the proper use of disinfectant solutions in personal service settings. We've discussed mycobacteria as being one of the next big problems in personal services and public health, and recent articles that I've read seem to concur. Dr. Sitar proposed that we undertake this research project actually at last year's sci-fi conference in Oshawa. And later that year, there was a rash of skin infections in Toronto connected to acupuncture services. Sorry, couldn't help that one. The outbreak in Toronto is the first case of a mycobacteria infection through a PSSP in Canada, and clearly reinforces the need to be vigilant about mycobacteria infections. Mycobacteria are ubiquitous in the environment and can be found in water, soil, dust, and animals. In the past, the infections that have been associated pretty much with water, injectable medication, invasive instruments, and procedures where the skin was not intact. The connection to municipal water needs to be recognized because mycobacteria are resistant to chlorine. I should point out that not all of the infections that I'm about to go through here were all confirmed by lab culture. Essentially, it's the number of infections is pointed out, but it doesn't necessarily mean that each one was a case of Mycobacterium abscessus or Mycobacterium fortuitum. The link was made in Toronto through a group of physicians who were meeting and discovered that they had clients with similar infections. These type of meetings must definitely be encouraged in the future. So on slide 23, the Mycobacterium abscessus infections in the United States infected about 87 people in about 16 states in 95 and 96. Now, adrenal cortex extract is an unlicensed alternative medicine, and it can be taken orally as well, but in this case it was injections. It's used for weight loss, fatigue, stress, easing withdrawal symptoms, depression, generally a cure-all. And the FDA claims that it's never been shown to be effective for treating any medical condition, and therefore it recalled it in 1996. And it wasn't actually the injections that were causing the infections. It was the poor manufacturing standards. The actual vials were contaminated. The next slide is another case of or cases of Mycobacterium abscessus. This is last year in New York, January to June. There was 25 cases of skin infections, again from cosmetic injections. And in this case, silicone, collagen, vitamins. There was some cases that required hospitalization, up to 51 days worth. And there was 15 of that 25 required invasive medical procedures and antibiotic therapy that lasted up to 6 months. One case had a bloodstream infection. Now, a thing to point out here with these is that it's the wounds were seeping fluid for months. So essentially, you're cruising around with this open wound for a long time. So naturally, that's a big concern. The next one is, again, Mycobacterium abscessus infections, and this is in Santiago, Chile, in July of December of last year, July 2 December. 51 cases of infections from five cosmetic clinics, and it was mesotherapy injections, and that's to reduce obesity. There was all 51 cases had extensive scarring, and again, abscesses having to be drained, surgery, up to 8 months of antibiotics. Now, the next one is Mycobacterium fortuitum, which is also classified as atypical mycobacteria, and that encompasses all mycobacteria outside of Mycobacterium tuberculosis. Excuse me. Now, the infections for this type of bacterium were first recorded in 1936, and that was vitamin injections. But this case was in a California pedicure establishment, and was the largest outbreak in the states. There was 110 people affected, various infections, and there was one case in particular where she actually had 37 open wounds, and it's very hard to treat. And like wounds typical of the next slide. At the time of the outbreak, the state of California investigators were inspecting, swabbing, and testing in 18 other shops in the area and found Mycobacterium fortuitum in 16 of 18 shops, which is not too surprising considering how common it is in the environment. The problems really occur when the numbers are large. In the right temperature, proper breeding environment, it multiplies very quickly. ABC News, because 2020 hired did an episode on this, they hired their own investigators as well in Houston, Dallas, Phoenix, and Boston, and as well found several violations in fecal bacteria, et cetera, in 24 of the 27 shops they went into. So clearly it was a problem in the States, and certainly with Barbara Walters having an episode on it on 2020, it caught a lot of people's attention. Now, the slide following the wound is, the whole point with that is that what I was trying to show is that even as things are starting to heal, you don't have the open draining, pussing wound, but you're going to get a lot of nasty scarring. And usually for a case like pedicure, the next slide, number 29 now, is, there's contaminated instruments. Following slide, contaminated environment. Following slide, reusing disposable tools is a very common occurrence in personal services because the operators do not know actually what is disposable and what is not in some cases. Also, beware of these so-called sanitizable emery boards, and that's what's actually printed on the emery board, if you can see it. Due to the nature of the surface of these tools, it can't be effectively cleaned or disinfected. And the following two slides are other examples of disposables. Emery boards, always been disposable. Buffing blocks, always been disposable. And 34th slide, which is the tub. Operators have to remember to clean and disinfect the foot tub. If operators have a tub with a recirculation system, I tell them after they've cleaned it with soap and water to rinse, dump, refill with water, and a bleach solution of maybe 1%, and let it run for 10 minutes. Now, the next slide was actually the problem in California. The suction screen was the issue. accumulation of dead skin, nails, hair, made for a very happy breeding environment for the mycobacteria. The suction screen should be part of at least a daily cleaning routine. Excuse me. Next slide. These recent cases are obviously personal service issues, and considering how popular medical spas and cosmetic clinics are becoming, we're definitely going to see more of these unless we do more to educate, promote, and enforce. Next slide, showing levels of disinfection. The levels of disinfection is a big problem when it comes to mycobacteria because it requires high-level disinfection. Unfortunately, most operators are stuck at the other end of the spectrum. They're all on low-level disinfectants. Although this chart claims that the low-level disinfection can kill Hep B and Hep C, there's been studies that prove otherwise, and I'll go into that a little later. Slide 38, we're talking about what the problems are. These are just some of the issues. Lack of knowledge of basic infection control is a big one for the operators. Not using the proper solutions, improper products, contact times. There's so many things that are that the operators have to be re-educated on. And the diseases themselves people aren't really aware of. Often carriers are not even aware that they are infected themselves because they don't show any signs or symptoms. Excuse me. Even after you start educating the operators, you always got to follow up because even though they're more aware of the diseases, they can still look at things the wrong way. Like, for example, I still get the operators who, you know, cut corners with their regular clients because of the old, it's okay, I know her, she's married with kids and, you know, nice husband. And, you know, that's really good for her, but a virus doesn't care about your social status. And the point you have to drive home is that they should treat everybody who walks through their door as potentially infected because they may not even know that they are infected, as I mentioned. Now, on slide 39, linkages, the link between developing the diseases and the infections is often lost. It's hard to really pinpoint any of this. Some incubation periods are up to 10 years for the case of HIV, or even worse. Some carriers, as I mentioned, never get sick, and we're actually lucky to find the link with the mycobacteria infections, and the physicians group in Toronto was great for that. But the thing is that I was thinking when I first read this that, well, maybe mycobacteria is a little easier to spot, but in retrospect, when I was reading over some more literature on it, some cases in the Toronto acupuncture outbreak didn't even notice the infection for about 5 months. And, you know, so I guess we were just lucky to get some of those connections and luckily for that physicians group. Now, it's not like a food poisoning where you can just match up food and stool samples and you've made your connection. And it's not the kind of thing where you can justify your program by answering, you know, like your typical, how many cases of Hep C did we get in nail salons last year versus food poisonings in food establishments. It just doesn't work that way. You're dealing with the long incubation periods and some cases that show no symptoms at all, so you're pretty lucky when you can trace the source. And that's just not with the typical bloodborne pathogens because, as we mentioned with the Toronto situation, not only was there the one who hadn't noticed anything for 5 months, but there's also been documented incubation periods of up to a year with the Mycobacterium abscessus infections. Now, the next slide is getting back to our original bloodborne pathogens, which was pretty much always the highlight of the PSSP. With the incubation periods, you also got the issues. There was a recent study in Quebec where one-third of the people with HIV were not even aware that they had it. Hep B immunization, well, that's started around probably, I'd say maybe 91, being offered mainly in grade 7 as part of an immunization program. And that's great for your younger staff when you're out there inspecting, but you might want to bring the older staff up to speed and let them know that immunization is available. The next slide, we're referring to Hep C. These are stats from the States. I think, I can't remember exactly the year of this conference, but I'm sure I have it somewhere if anybody wants further information on it. And as you can see by the numbers, over 4 million infected in the United States, over 3 million chronic carriers, 35,000 new cases per year. And the whole thing is that the virus is a lot hardier than HIV, you know, compared to our original blood-borne pathogens. And it can survive for quite some time. Hep C has always been a difficult one to get a lot of accurate information about. But we do know that it is a hardy virus and it can survive for long periods outside the body. Actually, I believe there was research that confirmed that under refrigerated conditions, you know, like a walk-in cooler or something, that the virus could survive for up to a year. Next slide is a bit of an eye-opener for some people. Most operators have to realize that it's not just junkies, anal sex, and blood transfusions that can transmit blood-borne pathogens and the like. And they don't always understand the ease of transmission of disease, like this case, where a healthcare worker contracted Hep C and HIV simply through chapped skin. The PSSP is clear about the fact that you do not have to see blood or be doing strictly invasive procedures to be at risk. Next slide is getting into the disinfectant dilemmas. As any public health inspector in the field knows, improper use of disinfectant solutions is the biggest problem in the personal services. This is the one of the main reasons why Dr. Sitar and I will be writing this manuscript on the proper use of disinfectant solutions, and I'll go into that more later. Next slide, the reason that this is one of the biggest problems in the industry is because of the lack of education. Suppliers and salespeople educate the operators, which is obviously an inherent conflict of interest there. Often operators are using surface disinfectants on tools. They're also not pre-cleaning the items to be disinfected. They're not fully immersing the item in the solution or have no concept of contact time. Everybody wants the quick fix, microwavable, 24-hour drive-through, instant answer. You know, they just want to spray and go, and it's just clearly doesn't work with, you know, basic infection control procedures. Now, the next slide. Here's another one that PHIs in the field will appreciate because it's a problem for us as well. You know, you go into an establishment, you're doing your inspection, you ask what they're using as a disinfectant, and usually it's a long list of this slide, and there's no other information on the package or label, etc. Dr. Sitar and I are planning to clarify and demystify these formulations so that public health professionals and the operators and staff actually know what they're using. Excuse me. Next slide. Most of the establishments that you will be dealing with out there are using semi-critical instruments. And that's usually the case for the ones that you're more concerned with anyway, with aesthetics and manicures and pedicures. And semi-critical instruments require intermediate level disinfection. So the bulk of your aesthetic places will need to use probably alcohol. Sometimes bleach is an option, but it's a little rough on the tools. And, you know, there's issues with bleach as well. Even hair salons that offer no other services will need to have intermediate level disinfection just in case someone gets nicked with scissors or clippers. But unfortunately, the bulk of them are using low-level disinfectants. Almost all of those low-level disinfectants are quaternary ammonium compounds. Health Canada and APIC, amongst other documents, lists quaternary ammonium compounds as low-level disinfectants to be used on non-critical surfaces, such as floors, walls, furnishings, and very clearly not to be used to disinfect instruments. So what you usually have in many of these locations is a bucket full of some liquid used over and over. For example, you get, say, Vinny the old school barber, who, of course, has never made anyone sick that he knows of, and he can shave the back of maybe 20 people's necks with one razor, and all he has to do in between is swish his blade around in his quote-unquote sterilizer. Now, his so-called sterilizer is usually a half-filled bucket of used, watered-down, low-level disinfectant with chunks of schmeg floating around between the combs and brushes. So some of these people actually believe that this works. Clearly, the education factor coming in there as well, and education being probably the biggest thing in this. Operators keep these containers at their workstations when they should have them next to a sink. So you can clean the item, then put it in a freshly made disinfectant for, you know, X amount of contact time. It has to be at the station, of course, because the clients have to see the pretty blue, green, or red liquid. Of course, as we all know, the more colorful the liquid is, the better it works. Thought I could get this through this without being sarcastic, but I guess I was wrong. The next slide One of my favorite old handouts from the head-to-toe conference on the effectiveness of barbicide on Hep C. What's really ridiculous about the whole barbicide situation is you can take a simple, non-critical item like a comb that has just been used, so therefore contaminated, and throw it in your bucket of disinfectant and leave it there for a week. So, like, nothing's going to happen to that comb. So, as you can imagine, if you throw, like, say, 12 dirty combs in there, not only is nothing happening, but it's kind of spreading the contamination around. You get a nice little soup going there. Now, on the next slide, we're going to get into the higher level of disinfection, which is obviously one of the first steps that you get when you're dealing with the operators. It's a great example of my earlier mention to make sure that you follow up on your operators. It's one thing to get your operators to the next level of disinfection, but you have to ensure that they're doing it properly as well. The next slide, you're going into a place, you have a stock of disinfectant solutions. The operator has bought an intermediate level solution as required, but he didn't read your report carefully enough, so you always got to make sure you look closely. The next slide is showing the container of disinfectant, which lists the alcohol at being 99%. Alcohol's optimum concentration is between 70 and 90%. Water is required to denature proteins, so a 99% solution will not cut it because it's too pure. And clearly, when they start doing the alcohol purchases, they generally all try to jump on that 99% bandwagon, or at least that's what I've seen. Next slide. There's manufacturers that they realize we're out there, and they're adjusting their product lines to comply with the PSSP, such as this bucket of isopropyl alcohol. And now, with this particular case, on the next slide, when you look really closely, I believe this is a Starnail product, pretty sure, and upon closer inspection, the percentage wasn't listed. So I contacted the Ontario representative, and she told me it was, in fact, a 99% solution, and they would be correcting the problem. Now, next slide. Always remember that it is a combination of which tool and how it is used that dictates the level of disinfection. This slide indicates not to use low-level disinfectants for instruments, but you probably want to consider that along with slide number 60, which considers levels along with type of item. Next slide. As I mentioned earlier, part of Dr. Sitar and I's research project is deciphering chemical formulations. Now, this is a copy of Health Canada's drug product database, and I've made it into a workable abbreviated version, and I've got that electronically as well if anybody needs it. It covers about 2,400 chemicals, I've got it in a pretty much a workable format. The next slide describes how each chemical is described, and that's what I've got actually on the charts, filling in all these areas. DIN numbers, obviously, usually a big concern with many people. Now, next slide, number 56. Identifying chemicals from out in the field has its share of complications, obviously. The thing is that ingredient labeling, it's not mandatory for cosmetics. Health Canada hopes to have this ingredient labeling situation mandatory by the end of this year. The other big issue is that cosmetics are exempt from MSDS sheets, WMIS laws, things like that. So that's a little bit of a concern there. Often you're going to find things with no labeling on them. 57, Dr. Sitar and I are hoping that our manuscript will clarify a lot of problems and want to make it in a format that's acceptable, obviously, for publication in medical journals, but we also want it to be usable because we want to give it out to health units, manufacturers, suppliers, operators, staff, clients. So it's meant to be an educational tool for everyone to use. 58, educational handouts are very useful for your target audience. This barbicide info sheet, for example, will save you a lot of time when you're in hair salons, especially if they are clearly hair salons that offer no other services. The following slide is of a flow chart, which has been very useful for aesthetics. They usually post it in the cleaning, disinfection, sterilization area, you know, over the sink. And that way, you know, they just have to follow the arrows. And, you know, the whole point is to try to make it as easy as possible for them. The next slide, disinfectant charts, also very useful. Just make sure that the charts consider the tool or action of the tool as well as the disinfectant level. The next slide is actually a summary of the personal services settings protocol, and I mailed that out to about, 800 establishments in Ottawa when I first started doing inspections. And it was also very useful to getting everyone up to speed, having people contact me, and, you know, by the time you get there, they've pretty much got it all wrapped up. It's and it kind of lessens the shock a bit for them, because they're all thinking that what they've been doing all along is fine, and you pretty much got to go in there and tell them to forget everything they ever learned. Now, the next slide is talks about piercing problems. No personal service chat would be complete without talking about the piercing issues. Age restriction is always coming up all the time. Have usually a lot of complaints is concerned parents calling about their kids getting pierced. But the thing is that with age restriction, it's a moral issue. It's not an infection control issue. So, like, really, if the only good use that could ever come of age restriction is if it would prevent jewelry stores from piercing babies with guns, and that's about the only good thing I can see coming out of that. Most body piercers have their own code about the age limit of piercing clients, and anyone below that age needs parental consent. When those kids get refused, what do you think happens? Well, of course, they go to jewelry stores and hair salons, or go underground completely and get it done in someone's basement, or do it themselves or to themselves. And driving these services underground by putting age limitations on it is only going to increase the amount of infections and really put those kids at serious risk. Most of the infections from a piercing out there are due to poor aftercare. Some piercings can take up to a year to heal, and there are so many things that people don't consider. The busy season for piercing, for example, and tattooing, et cetera, is the summer, which is another unfortunate coincidence, because you want to stay out of pools, lakes, rivers, the sun, you want to prevent sweating. So these are all things you got to consider when you're healing. And obviously, it's hard to do that in the summertime. The next slide is a handout of an aftercare sheet, which is based on the personal services settings protocol, and as part of the protocol, providing aftercare is required and is now required for tattooing as well. Now, earlobe piercing, always one of my favorites. The ear piercing section is now called the earlobe piercing section and has a note that's been added to confirm that ear piercing guns are for use on the lobe of the ear only. If you do a piercing with a sterile single-use disposable cartridge, you should not transmit HIV, Hep B, or Hep C, as long as you understand the concept of cross-contamination, but we would be extremely negligent if we ignored other diseases, secondary infections, and just plain old-fashioned mutilation. Shattering the cartilage is always a big risk when using piercing guns also, and is, of course, rightly so, banned in some of the United States. The next slide is of the gun itself. Now, these devices have come a long way since the days of tagging cattle, but there's still a risk. This type of gun, which you may see either in black or red, is an old Stud-X model. Is essentially banned. Really, the only way that you can use it is if you sterilize the gun between uses. Now, you're going to melt it in an autoclave, but technically, could you really use a high-level disinfectant, sometimes called a cold sterilant? That's an issue that obviously comes up a lot in jewelry stores. First of all, they would need a sink, and secondly, a staff that knows how to use and dispose of toxic chemicals. Will they let the gun soak in the glutaraldehyde for the required amount of time needed, et cetera, et cetera? I don't think a jewelry store can afford to buy that much insurance. And when you consider the staff who are actually dealing with this, they're not the kind of people that I would feel comfortable who come in for a two-hour shift on the weekend handling toxic chemicals. So I think it's pretty safe to assume that banned is a good label for this. And the next slide is highlighting the parts that actually get contaminated with bodily fluid after a piercing, and they actually have been linked to cases. I found a case, some cases of viral hepatitis in 1973 in an article in JAMA in March of 74. And the whole thing with the article, as I'm reading through it, it was so hard for them to try to prove the link, and really quite frustrating of a read as well. And trying to focus on how to make the link with the incubation periods is always going to be difficult. I doubt that clear links will really ever be made with this. Now, 67, if you compare that to slide 66, you will see the stud adapter and clasp retainer are disposable in this model. And this is not the preferred model because you got to deal with a sink. With this one, you're going to have a sink. There's a lot more handling. But the reason that a lot of people get this is because it's cheaper and they can use up their earring stock. The next slide is the StudX model that many of us are aware of, and the following slide is just to show that it's also comes in white now, or that's how I've been seeing it more so lately. The following slide is the Inverness model, and the following slide is the Blomdahl model from Sweden. And the following slide, which is disposable cartridge, essentially that's just to point out the concept that they all have the same general cartridge concept. The following slide is to point out medical plastic earrings. If you see them, don't worry about it. It is sterilized ethylene oxide gas. As you can see in the next slide, it's been promoted for quite some time now. The following slide actually shows the earrings. I've had some concerns because of the gauge of the earring, and I've really only had one complaint with this type of earring. The whole reason that it was put together is clearly to lower reactions to nickel. Now, the following slide, getting up to 76, is body-piercing jewelry. Now, that is autoclavable. I believe it's some sort of Teflon, but I'll try to find out and send the information out. Following slide, getting into the problems with piercing guns, and that's slide number 78. They're, you know, obviously, as I mentioned, some of these already, the lobe, the node on guns. And what happens is there was a situation where with this disinfection solution where what they were doing is they were spritzing the earring with the solution before doing the piercing. So what's going on there, which is very confusing, is they're disinfecting a sterilized item. And in that case, actually, there was a slide that comes later on with the story. It was there was a case of Pseudomonas. Now, the slide number 79 shows a navel, which is essentially rejecting a piercing, and kind of gives you an idea just by looking at it. The gun's not suitable for all body parts, although I've seen it on several ones, and there's just a certain amount of mechanics that you can't avoid for using piercing guns. The next slide, a little boy with an infection, his cartilage obviously is swollen up pretty good there, and the following slide is just to point out that even after the surgery, the draining, the antibiotics, et cetera, you're still going to have some pretty serious damage. Now, slide 82 is the one that I was talking about, the Pseudomonas infections in a jewelry store in Oregon, actually where seven people, aged 10 to 19, were pierced with sterilized earrings that were then sprayed with the disinfectant. And oddly enough, Oregon is one of the states where cartilage piercing is actually illegal. The body modification, I just wanted to highlight changing trends, but we can kind of hop through that really quickly. The following slide, surface piercings, there's really nothing new there anymore, but it just goes to show something that wasn't really popular and practiced when the PSSP first came out. It is now quite common. Dermal punch. The dermal punch method is also not a new one, but may not be well known. It's a biopsy tool, usually provided from a medical supplier in prepackaged sterile disposable, as you can see by slide number 85. 86, just to show a little bit more the opening of the dermal punch, the reason it is disposable is because the tissue is completely removed and it stays inside the tip of the tool. And there's another thing with dermal punch is that there's a lot of blood flow, obviously. If you're removing tissue, that's going to happen. It's only really useful with the ear or parts of the ear, because, again, it's the whole mechanics of it. Implants, well, they're gaining slightly more popularity, but then again, I said the same thing about surface piercings in 99. So, really, I haven't heard much of this other than Montreal, and obviously, inspectors around the GTA might want to keep their eyes open for this a little more. The following slides, next two slides, show some implants. Now, the big thing with that, isn't it surgery? Okay, well, It's cutting it pretty close, but on slide 90, again, the Regulated Health Protection Act exempts tattoo artists, acupuncturists, electrologists, ear and body piercers from controlled acts. Now, I don't think the act was written in the spirit of a lot of these new trends, so that's a topic that will probably be revisited in the future. Now, the tattooing changes, just briefly, there's some minor changes. The needle bar is disposable, the aftercare that I mentioned earlier, and the location of the sink is not as critical anymore as long as they have access to it. The tattoo machine is the next slide. The needle bar is actually the part that slides down from the armature bar pin. The machine cannot be sterilized, so naturally it's covered with disposable covering. The only exposed part is from the tube vise down. so the part that's hanging down at the bottom. And all those parts are cleaned and sterilized. The following slide is the needle bar. Now, the entire bar is disposable, which is not a problem because they cost about 17 cents. And the following slide just shows a better view of the needle bar, again, referring to the paintbrush analogy, because you solder on certain needle configurations for each one. Cleaning and sterilizing, I can just hop over to the next slide, ultrasonic. One thing that's coming up a little more is I'm seeing it actually in nail salons, ultrasonic cleaners at the stations, obviously to prevent people from getting up, but the reason I'm bringing up ultrasonic is the following slide, which is actually a good slide to show that body piercing and tattoo artists are quite responsible, and please ask them questions because they are just a wealth of information and they're actually quite proud of what they're doing. So don't be afraid to approach them for information because they were really useful for me when I started. The next slide is meant to show aerosolization. Unfortunately, I'd gotten there just after she cleaned it, but I'd seen this before. Even with the lid on this ultrasonic, they were doing the cleaning, and the first time I actually saw it, she cleaned off the inside of it, and it was full of black soot. So clearly, you're going to be getting some aerosolization, which is why you want the ultrasonic in a separate room, because you don't want that stuff landing all over your surfaces and tools. Following slide, we get into autoclaving. Sterilizers, the spore tests, that's one thing I just wanted to discuss. There's a three spore test thing that's coming up in the new PSSP. I think that what might be useful or a little different from that, which we should consider, is there's on-the-spot spore tests, essentially where you can measure the level of sterilization. You just pop it in the sterilizer and you do a run. That would work out well. Actually, another thing I should bring up, Jerry from Kingston called me about accredited labs the other day because he had an operator who had his own incubator, wanted to do his own spore testing. There is nothing in the new PSSP that says that it must be an accredited lab, but clearly when you think of water and all that, I think that that would be a given. The next slide is Prestige, the pressure cooker, and it actually passed the spore tests. It's the most affordable autoclave there is, so a lot of people do get it. The Canadian Micropigmentation Center in Toronto actually supplies it. The issue with that was packaging, which is addressed on the next slide. What was happening is when with this autoclave, you are supposed to not package the tools. And the letter that was sent out essentially clarifies that you can package it. It won't nullify the sterilization. So then you hop over to slide 103, which is getting into aesthetics. So obviously, double dipping, still an issue. But it's a simple one, but not really. You know, the whole issue with that is... going on to cosmetic policies, which is the next bullet. I'm trying to put a policy together for Shoppers Drug Marts, Loblaws, Giant Tigers, various cosmetic counters, Lancome, whatever. So anybody who might want to get in on just helping me out with some signage on that, just contact me. The next slide, whenever you see that metal spatula, you know that they're reusing, and that's doubled up and clearly. Don't believe that they're just stirring the wax with that. The following slide is a double dipping issue that usually people don't consider. Sharpening of eye and lip liner pencils and not cleaning and disinfecting the sharpener. Actually, the sharpener ends up being the source of contamination. If you move on to sharps, the point being that this particular situation, there was we have drop boxes for sharps containers here in Ottawa, but it's not meant for businesses. And that's one point that I wanted to make up. But the following slide is the big point with sharps. Just about every operator that I've ever talked to who works with invasive procedures has at least had one needle stick injury. So clearly that's something that we have to inform them more. What's happening with this pile of blades that you're looking at, it's actually inside a sharps container, is some of the needles that they use for extractions or ingrown hairs or whatever, they'll recap them and then throw them in the sharps container. And, again, the needle stick injuries. Deer candling, well, there's a lot of bogus activities out there, and that was one of them. Medical spas, I think, is going to be our next big problem, and I just want to touch on that because I haven't really gotten in there too much lately. Laser hair removal. Most of my electrologists are no longer doing laser hair removal, not doing the traditional electrolysis anymore, except for maybe around the eyes. They're pretty much all moved over to laser equipment. Now, the problem is, with the laser equipment, the following requirements, slide 111, is fine with the old style of equipment, but if you keep going, the new style of lasers is, again, one of those issues with ease of use, winning over anything else, is that you're getting more of the diode ones. If you go to slide 113, you'll see it's actually in direct contact with the skin. What happens is you're shaving the area first, and it's not actually cutting the skin. Only CO2 does that, but it's destroying the follicle, and you're getting sometimes fluid coming back up and resurfacing. And because you've got increased heat, you've got increased blood flow. So the following slide shows the device a little better. It's clearly not built for cleaning, disinfecting, sterilizing. And if you go to the next slide, it's actually the handpiece. It's not something that you can put in a sterilizer or autoclave. You can't even dip that in disinfectant. So that's a situation that clearly is going to have to be addressed. And the following slide is microdermabrasion, which essentially you're sandblasting the skin. And the powdered aluminum oxide crystals that are used for the sandblasting are very expensive. So you get a lot of operators actually recycle them. So the trick is you want to get the microdermabrasion tools that have the closed-loop system from beginning to end. Sometimes there was older ones where tips and lines would be disposable, or at the very least, semi-critical objects. But again, a lot of things that are coming up now are for ease of use. Luckily, it's not the case with microdermabrasion as much, because now that you're getting the closed-loop system a lot more. I just wanted to bring those up because so many of my electrologists now are just, they're doing laser and veins and wrinkles and fat reductions and tummy tucks, and they're into all kinds of things. Medical spas, I think that's going to be a big concern coming up. Quickly, over methyl methacrylate, slide 118, it was banned in the States quite some time ago, and in the 70s. Now it's banned in Canada. The ban's in effect in Canada this year at the point of entry. Again, hard to enforce because the labeling requirements, the MSDS, the WMIS, the air quality. And the next slide is some helpful tips for you and the operators to help them spot methyl methacrylate, because quite often they won't even know they're using it. But these tips really do clarify it. And it's the removal of the nail, which is pretty much the biggest giveaway. And again, it's not a direct infection situation, but as is shown in the next slide, infections do lead to amputation in some cases, in this one case, obviously. There's the Health Canada information on the ban, which is slide 121. If anybody needs that, you could probably go to the Health Canada site. If you can't find it, just give me a call. Quickly, again, the labeling laws. There's some problems with being able to identify certain products. There's another one, actually, that I should mention to you quickly. Is there's a one-minute manicure product out there that a lot of my complaints have been because it changes the skin color. Some people have actually had their hands go orange on them, but clearly it goes away, so it's not a major concern. And just in case you see that, don't be too concerned. It's nothing tragic. Enforcement, obviously, Section 13 orders. I've got lots of templates of Section 13 orders. And education is pretty much the biggest thing that you're going to work with. Now, I think that I've left a little time here for some questions. So if there is any, go right ahead there.
Thank you very much. That's a heck of a lot of material to cover in 1 hour. You've done it splendidly.
Thank you.
Thank you, Christian, for that presentation.
Hi, Christian. It's Anna from Toronto Public Health. I'm here with Cecilia and Lisa, and we really enjoyed your presentation. Thank you very much. We just wanted to ask you a quick question. You kept referring to the new PSS protocol. Can you let us know what date and what draft that is? Because we haven't received it.
Well, pretty much, I think I'm working with the same one that you have. Essentially, the latest one I've got, I think, is the August 2002. And then the only thing that was really tacked on after that was the acupuncture section. And I'll contact you later just to make sure we're working on the same one here.
Great. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Hi, have those officially been sent out, the August 2002?
Actually, nothing has been sent out yet. What happened is we, as part of the working group, and, you know, Anna, Cecilia, and Lisa are actually a great example of people who are involved in that. We had the finished product, and then Erica Bontovic at the ministry was had forwarded that to the lawyers to dot the I's and cross the T's and all that. And we've been waiting for it ever since. Now, unfortunately, the situation is that Dr. Bontovic's got seconded to the SARS project, so there's no one in the office at Toronto right now, but they are looking to replace her because right now she's just fully committed to the SARS project. And as soon as anything happens, clearly I will inform everyone.
Christian, it's Sherry from the Algoma Health Unit. Hello.
Hi. I was just wondering, do you have a template for inspections of different types of premises where it's like a checklist or information that can be used and left at the same time?
What I usually use is a copy of the mail-out. If you just email me, I'll send you that. I was originally going to make an actual checklist type format, but I'm the only inspector in Ottawa who does personal services, so the checklist would have been to educate all the other operators. Actually, I use a blank form. It's actually a pool form. But that's because, well, the personal services, it's in my head anyway, so I didn't really need a checklist. But what I've done is the mail-out, which is a summary of the protocol, I leave that with the operator. And on the blank form, I'll say, well, hand hygiene must be required, C number 3, whatever. And I'll send that to you, and you'll see that it's not really a super effective checklist, but it can be used for that.
Great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Hi, Algoma. It's Anna Miranda from Toronto Public Health. We're more than happy to share with you all the materials that we've developed as well.
Wonderful.
So if you want to call us here at 338-7492 and ask to speak with Lisa Penny, okay, and we can send you all the materials that we've developed as well.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Bye now.
Christian?
Yes.
Hi, Cecilia Alterman from Toronto Public Health.
Hi, Cecilia.
What I noticed that you didn't have, and we have included in our inspection form, is we're asking that all the needles be individually wrapped. And I think that was in the new draft protocol.
It is, yeah. The new acupuncture section, it clearly says prepackaged, sterilized. It was just with my situation. I actually had an acupuncturist here in Ottawa who was buying from that Japanese supplier. Now, I was trying to use the personal services as much as possible and as close to it while trying to avoid the whole reusing of needles. So essentially what I stipulated was sterile, single-use, disposable, but I didn't stipulate the prepackaged. And clearly that was something that I was hoping for, and by the bad luck of the outbreak, now we do have that, and I have readjusted my acupuncture documents so that it reflects that. Even though it's not released yet, I think I can justify it.
Okay, I don't know if you're understanding me. I'm not talking about the pre-package. I'm talking about the individual wrapping
of
needle. How they come in groups of five in a package. We're asking that those cannot be used, that they have to be individually wrapped. So each needle has to be pre-packaged and sterile in its own package.
Is there a lot of suppliers for that service? Because most of the ones that I've been seeing, when they use the Asian manufacturers, that's where you get all your bundling stuff.
I've seen them in most of the acupuncture places that I've inspected.
Yeah.
I've had no problems with those needles. Like, I see them everywhere. They come with the little plastic sheath.
Yep.
I just find, because after our experience, one of the problems was that this acupuncturist would have leftover needles, so let's say 3 or 4 from the bunch, and they would be left either in alcohol or, put it this way, in an unsterile environment. So,
of course.
So my fear was that people would be reusing them, and we want to discourage people from sterilizing them again.
Absolutely. I'm with you 100% on that.
So, I want to really push the ministry to keep the individually wrapped portion in the acupuncture section.
Well, I think that the last version of that acupuncture section I saw maybe had a little red writing over it here and there, but it's for all intents and purposes, I think that everyone was happy with that version of it.
Okay.
Have you heard differently?
No, I haven't.
Okay, good.
Yeah, no, just because I didn't see the presentation, I thought maybe you had heard that it was taken out.
No, I'm still awaiting a response.
It's Dale from Stratford. You're saying the needle bars are now disposable.
That's correct.
Where do the operators dispose of those things?
It'll fit in your sharps container. Usually the guys that are doing tattooing and stuff have the big bulk containers anyway. And the needle bar really wasn't that far of a leap. Because most of them were actually disposing of it already. I think if you really break it down, it's like 17 cents a bar. And by not having to snap off needles or, rework with it, they lower the risk of needle stick injuries themselves. So that one was a slam dunk, and the operators are taken to it right away.
Okay, so they can just dispose of that in sharps container.
Yeah, everything will go in the sharps container. And, like I said, they do have a lot of the big containers, because also a lot of body piercers will throw their cork in there as well.
Right. Okay.
folk, I'm going to have to invite you to ask the rest of your questions by email or by phone. Christian, thank you again for that presentation. You brought us an incredible amount of information in the last hour. It has been very helpful. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thanks again to Virox Technologies for their support, and thanks to all of you for joining us today and for being so quick with your question. Hopefully we'll all talk again. Until then, stay safe. Goodbye.